Hi, this is Alan Chartak, and I'm delighted to be back in conversation with Dr. Gregory Dewey, always a very interesting man. He became the ninth president of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, ACPHS, on July 1st, 2014. Prior to joining ACPHS, Dr. Dewey served for 5 years as provost at the University of Laverne in California, a comprehensive doctoral university that enrolls approximately 8,000 students across 4 colleges and 9 regional campuses. In that capacity, he oversaw academic affairs, student services, enrollment management, financial aid, and athletics for the institution. Athletics being the most important. Dr. Dewey previously served as Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs and the Finnegan Chair at the Keck Graduate Institute, KGI, of Applied Life Science in Claremont, California. As a founding faculty member of this pioneering institution, he played a key role in KGI's growth during his 10 years at the school, including the development of its groundbreaking Masters of Bioscience program, the first professional Master of Science program in the country. Dr. Dewey began his academic career in 1982 as an assistant professor at the University of Denver and eventually rose to the rank of full professor. He spent 18 years at Denver, including 5 years as chair of the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry. Welcome back, Dr. Dewey.
Well, thank you, Alan. Thank you for that long, comprehensive bio introduction. Well, it's a pleasure to be back.
Well, so my first question is, you know, your name is Dewey. Are you related to any of the important Deweys, like John Dewey or Thomas Dewey or the guy who owned our house, who was the judge at the, Justin Dewey, who was the judge at the Lizzie Borden trial?
So I don't believe I'm related to Thomas Dewey, the presidential candidate. I was born on the day that John Dewey died, but I don't believe I'm related to him. However, we do believe we are related to Admiral George Dewey.
Oh, Admiral Dewey. Yeah.
And so that's a connection with a historic Dewey.
Well, that's good.
And the other thing when I visited the Saratoga battlefield, they have this little database, and you can see who fought in the battle, and there are 8 Deweys fought in the Battle of Saratoga. So I surely must be related to one of those.
Well, sure. Dewey's a big name. And this, there's no question about it. When my mother was asked if we were related to somebody or other, she would always say, yes. She would just sort of say yes and put her hand over her mouth. So maybe you should do that. But in any case, I am so fascinated and so glad you're here with us because pharmacy is huge. It is a huge issue. There are some factoids that come to my mind. When somebody graduates from your institution, what do they have behind them? Is it like a 5-year program?
It's a 6-year program.
6-year program.
The first 2 years, they call them pre-pharmacy years, and they're very similar to what you would take as a science undergraduate major. It would be similar to the freshman and sophomore year. And then they qualify.
Wait. Does that mean they come to you right out of high school?
Yes.
Oh, it does. Okay, I got it now.
And then they qualify for the pharmacy program. We call those P1 through P4 years, or professional years. So it's a 6-year degree program with the 4 professional years, and they end up with a doctorate in pharmacy.
Right. They have a doctorate in pharmacy. Now, here's something that will attract attention to our audience. When they go to work in one of the larger firms or any independent drugstore, how much money do they make?
They make typically over $100,000 a year if they go into retail pharmacy.
Right.
So just recently, the Brookings Institute did a study on value added in higher education. Of course, the cost of higher education has always been a concern. It's a national concern. And people have talked about return on investment to your college expenses. So Brookings did a new study, just came out, where they asked the question, having attended this college, what value was added versus, you know, looking at the demographics, what the predicted salaries were. So they looked at alumni 10 years out at what their actual salaries was, and then they had a computer model that said what their predicted value was. And the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences had the highest value added in the nation.
You were number one.
Number one. And I think Harvard was number 8 or something. So,
what's a liberal arts degree? I mean, if you're going to go out and the first thing you're going to do is get a $100,000 salary, that's got to tell you something.
Yeah. But it's not just the high end that where we were successful. It was because our predicted was also low.
I'm sorry. Help us with that distinction.
So the actual salaries that they got was quite high. But from the socioeconomic backgrounds of our students, the predicted salaries were also lower than you would predict from a Harvard student.
Yeah, so Harvard brings in, you know, the creme de la creme of the great society. But the College of Pharmacy may bring in people who have come from a lower economics, SES economic status, right?
Yeah, so that gives us a bigger delta, biggest value added.
I like it.
I liked it, too. And our enrollment management, our admissions officer really liked it as well.
I'll bet the phones didn't stop ringing from the day that little factoid came out.
Yeah, we were very excited about it. And, you know, it's also having coming out of Brookings, you know, it's not like it was a industry-sponsored thing. You know, they're respected and an impartial
Makes sense, doesn't it?
It does make sense.
Now, in the old days, doctors were at the sort of top of that list, you know.
Right.
Mom and dad put up the money for the medical school or loans, and then you were pretty well assured a very good life after that. That's not as much true with doctors anymore, I think.
Yeah, I'm not as much on top of the dynamics with doctors, but, you know, certainly doctors is still a very lucrative profession. But, you know, this isn't why our students do this. At the end of the day, what makes me most proud of our students is they are very smart. They're scientifically great talent, they're quantitative problem solvers, but they ultimately want to give back to their community.
And you know that how?
Because of the careers they go into. These are students that could go into PhDs, they could go into a huge range of fields, but invariably they get involved in healthcare professions that really I see them as making a difference. The big problem we have is we're in an era of incredible scientific advances. How do we bring those scientific advances to therapies? How do we translate basic discoveries into something that benefits humanities? And this is the path our students choose to go into.
But if you come, as you mentioned before, from a lower SES than you would do at Harvard, and you're guaranteed at least $100,000.
Well, that's certainly a pull.
But I'm glad you're speaking in their behalf, because that makes great sense.
But let me tell you another thing about our students. They do incredible volunteer work. They are in the community doing a lot of stuff.
While
they're students. Yeah. So I would say we have over a dozen of our student volunteer working at Whitney Young. Right. If you look at the rescue mission, I know we have at least four volunteer students working there. I was just recently at a juvenile diabetes fundraiser, and I counted 15 students staffing that fundraiser. So we have a great commitment to American Cancer Society. We do an annual Relay for Life where we've raised more money than many large, much larger schools. So our students are engaged.
Okay, this is all very good. I appreciate that a lot, and you're telling us about it. I wanted to ask you about something. I was recently talking to a physician who said that one of the great heart killers is stress. Now, you know, if you're standing behind that counter, right, and some doctor has given you a prescription which you can hardly read because, you know, their handwriting. So that's changing now, of course. They're doing a lot more on the computer.
Right.
But stress has got to be a big part of what your people face when they get out of there.
The students?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, any young person coming out trying to make it.
No, but I'm talking about the responsibility. You know, a political scientist says or that to you, that's one thing. But when, you know, they give you the wrong med or the wrong amount or, you know, that kind of thing, that could be very stressful, and they got to be thinking about that.
Yeah, so you have to understand this actually plays into, I would say, the basic mindset and mentality of a pharmacist, that they're very transactional and very precise. So they are detailed-oriented people, that where precision is important. So if you're looking at a 100-milligram tablet versus a 50-milligram tablet, that could lead to an overdose. So they are very detailed-oriented. They're very quantitative. Because what they're doing is really critical. Someone could have adverse reactions. that, you know, they have to guard against that. In a way, they're very similar to an engineer's mentality. If you're designing a supersonic jet, the precision of that design is very important. So the precision of a prescription is very important.
We're talking to Dr. Gregory Dewey, who became the 9th president of the Albany College of Pharmacy. Yeah. But here's the thing. Let's say you don't have a good memory. I don't have a great memory. Let's say you're supposed to take a thyroid pill every morning.
Yeah.
And then you get out of the house and you say, did I take that thyroid pill or didn't I take that thyroid pill? Now, your pharmacists have to be, to some degree, very observant to know that the person who they're dealing with may have a particular problem. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And this is a whole new area of pharmacy called medication therapy management, so that someone wakes up in the morning saying, you know, I'm feeling pretty good. I think I'll skip my meds. That could be a very bad thing to do.
Or could be fatal.
Or, you know, these meds are expensive. I think I'll cut the pills in half. Well, that makes them virtually useless. Even worse thing is, I forgot yesterday. Maybe what I'll do is I'll double up today. That could lead to an overdose. So medication therapy management, medication adherence is very important, and our students are increasingly trained. We need our students in a counseling role, not just over-the-counter role.
They have to be psychologists in many ways.
They have to understand they have to understand human behavior, right?
But they have to know who they're dealing with, the particular client that they are looking at and saying, I better be careful here because this person has a problem that maybe somebody else doesn't have.
Right. So, and the other issue where they have to do management is with multiple medications.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's not uncommon for someone with high blood pressure to not just be on one med, but maybe 3 or 4 meds because of various complications. So then you have to look at drug-drug interactions, making sure you have compatibility. If I pick up a drug from one provider and a drug from a second provider, no one ever necessarily checks to see that you have compatible prescriptions.
Well, was that a bad idea to pick them up from different providers?
Absolutely. I mean, if you don't have anyone overseeing what your entire medical regime. I've talked to our students that have gone into nursing homes. It's not uncommon for someone in a nursing home to be 20 or 30 different medications.
Wow.
Can you imagine just the complexity of figuring out how to take these and what order you take them in, and yet let alone the drug-drug interactions? So it is a very complicated world. And the problem is physicians are not really educated to deal with that world. A standard medical education may have 1 semester of pharmacology. Our students have 6 years of training, and this is why it's important for pharmacists to have provider status.
Now, that is a very interesting point, because now you go into the pharmacy, and little by little, we're beginning to see that pharmacists are allowed to do certain kinds of things that were once restricted to doctors or nurses, so that we see, for example, getting a flu vaccine or getting a shingles vaccine. I think you can get shingles now, too.
Immunization.
Yeah. So we've been over this before, but it's worth going over again.
Yeah.
I happen to believe that with the shortage of providers in the United States, medical providers, that because of the extensive training that your people get, that they ought to be able to do more.
They absolutely need to do more, and this is a national issue. It's also a local issue. If you look at primary care coverage, New York State is estimated only about 45% of our primary care need is actually being covered.
Exactly.
If you look at primary care physicians, 8% of primary care physicians are not taking any new patients. If you happen to be on Medicaid, 38% of primary care physicians will not take you as a new patient. So especially at the lower economic levels, primary care is not being met, and somebody has to fill the gap.
Yeah. So now this becomes a war of lobbyists, doesn't it, in a way?
Absolutely, it does.
So we know that the American Medical Association and medical societies are very good at lobbying and have been for years. What about the pharmacists?
The pharmacists have not historically been as strong as successful lobbyists, but this has to come forward, and we have to push it. We do have, you know, congressmen like Tonko who are very interested in and pushing for provider status for pharmacists. And, you know, we do have some progressive states. California and Oregon have been very progressive about...
What have they done?
Well, they were first allow immunization. There are a much wider range of practice that they can use. And most recently, and somewhat controversial, is they can prescribe birth control pills. But in general, they have allowed pharmacists earlier on than the rest of us to pursue, you know, some of these wider roles, more clinical roles.
If you were Nostradamus, what would you predict?
I think ultimately there's a certain inevitability of pharmacists becoming taking on provider roles, and it's because we have unmet need. And as the Affordable Care Act comes into greater fruition, I think there's a certain inevitability about it.
Especially if you're taking a whole class of people who are taking Medicaid at the lower end of society's allocation of resources, and nobody will see them.
That's right. So this is one of the motivations for our student-operated pharmacy is we want to provide a pharmacy.
Let's talk about that for a second. I should ask the question. Then you'll answer it, and then we'll be on the same page, because otherwise people will say, what's he talking about?
Yeah.
The Albany College of Pharmacy has now opened up its own student-operated pharmacy, right?
That's right.
And what's that going to do? It's like going to a barber college. Would you be afraid that your haircut would not be all that good if somebody would stick you with a scissors?
Well, you know, there are some good culinary schools that have great...
Indeed.
great meals. So the student-operated pharmacies that will be embedded in a hometown health clinic in Schenectady. We are going to launch a second one, which will be in Albany. It's a not-for-profit pharmacy. It will have a licensed pharmacist that will be the supervisor, and our students will be the workers in the pharmacy.
And will they have, as we say around here, insurance?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You sound like one of my Board of Trustee members.
Right, well, sure.
As an important consideration. So we want to do two things with the student-operated pharmacy. We want to have our students have that experience really on the ground, working, dealing with people directly, and have the experience running the pharmacy, doing the business end of it, but also interacting with patients. But it's not just going to be an independent community pharmacy. We're going to put in pharmacy services that will move us along the line to provider status.
So, for example?
So, like the medication therapy management, what I just talked about. We want people to come in and we can reconcile the medications. Oh, we're filling your prescription. Why don't you go over here and talk to the pharmacist and let's look at all your prescriptions? Or you're not doing well with this drug. Why don't you bring in all the medications you have and let's sit down and look at everything you're taking and see if it's compatible? Or let's talk about adherence. The other thing we want to do is we want to do screening and counseling. So that, while you're here getting your prescription, why don't we screen you for diabetes and we can talk about your diet? So we want to embed a lot of services that will really serve the community. So it's two things. It gives our students entree to those higher services. For our non-pharmacy students, it allows them to get involved in public health projects and counseling projects. And it's a great outreach to our community. We feel like we're going to put these two pharmacies who are in medically underserved areas, Medicaid populations. If these low-level services can keep people out of the ER.
So a couple of things. First of all, is this unique or other colleges of pharmacy begun to do this?
We're certainly not the first, but it is very unique. The only other one that is doing it to the extent that we're about to do is Duquesne University set up a pharmacy in the Hill District of Pittsburgh, a very underserved area, and they're in their fourth year of that. And we had a great visit to see how Duquesne was doing and learn some lessons from them, and we're off to do that here. So hometown health, in Schenectady is really serves a medically underserved area. Our pharmacy in Albany will be in the South End, where it will be announced.
South End being the also medically underserved.
Also medically underserved. And we'll be setting that up, announcing details about that shortly.
Well, you know, you brought me to an interesting place. Of course, if you have populations that are diverse, often of color, what is the college doing and how much has it been doing to recruit people who would inspire confidence because, frankly, they were, you know, of the same color or previous economic status that the people who were underserved were?
You mean in terms of diversity on campus?
Yes.
Yeah, so right now our student body is probably roughly 65% Caucasian. The rest are minorities. A lot of that would not be called underserved minorities.
It could be Indian or Asian.
But if you looked at our underserved minorities, it's about 12%.
That's pretty impressive, actually.
It's not bad. It's not bad, but it's an area that we need to work on. But the important thing is to have credibility for our students and have them give them the cultural competency to work in these communities. As I said earlier, they have a history of getting involved in these communities, and that's a good thing that we can build on that. But we want this will be a much more organized venue for us to do that. The other thing we want to do is we want to build community boards. So we're not just a bunch of academics coming in and telling a community what we think they need. We want to be genuine partners, and we will build community advisory boards so that we can really work with community-based organizations, understand what the needs of the community are, look at some of the health indicators in that community and say, hey, how can we budge some of these health indicators? How can we really advance it? But it's a community effort. It's not just us coming in and trying to push an agenda forward.
We're talking to Dr. Gregory Dewey. This is the 9th president of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Okay, so Dr. Dewey, so let me ask you this. You know, I know people who live in New York now, and there is a chain, New York City, there's a chain of, there's nothing on Broadway, it would seem, except for Duane Reade's or CVS's or other pharmacies. How has the rise of chains affected your students?
You know, that's an interesting question. It's a good question. You know, we have been a pharmacy school since 1881. Our pharmacy students is almost the history of independent pharmacy in New York State. Virtually, back in the day, it was nothing but independent pharmacies.
Sure. My Uncle Joe.
And we have some of that history is in our alumni. We have, I would say, probably at least a dozen families that have three generation of pharmacists that are alums, and that
many of whom own their drugstores.
Yeah, it's the store passing from generation to generation, and so you're going to inherit the store, and you're going to go to ACPHS and get your degree. So we're very proud of our legacy families.
And then yet along comes CVS, which they did in Great Barrington. Offers an incredible amount of money to the guy who has taken over for his dad, and the guy can't say no.
That's right. Well, the guy's getting near the end of his life. He wants a house in Florida, and
no, this guy wasn't getting near the end of his life. It was just an enormous amount of money.
Yeah, and so the temptation was to sell out, and we saw that happen in the mid '80s. That many of the independents got swept away. And there was something lost in a way because those independents were pillars of those small towns. People would come to them for advice. In general, most people, from survey results, most people would say that are more comfortable talking to their pharmacist than maybe to their doctor. It was part of the community. With the retails come in, and some of that got swept away, but I feel like we are also kind of returning to that with these minute clinics that they're putting into some of the retail. You're seeing a more attempt to be more comprehensive in the way you interact with folks. And there is a company, a wholesale drug company called Rochester Drug Co-op, who's actually supporting the growth of independence in Rochester and Syracuse and throughout the state. So we're actually seeing some return of that old independent pharmacy and that tradition.
But my question was, returning to the question, how has the existence of these great chains
Our students basically support those chains. They are the employees of the chains. Mm-hmm. And so most of our students, when they come in to their studies, either think, I'm going to go into retail pharmacy or I'm going to go into hospital pharmacy. Very few of them think I'm going to be an independent.
Mm.
And then a few of them go into the pharmaceutical industry.
This hospital pharmacy, this fellow I was referring to, actually did go into our hospital, became the hospital pharmacist.
Yeah.
It doesn't pay. It can't possibly pay as well as working for more than $100,000 in a pharmacy.
It's probably not too bad, though. I mean, it's not too. And the other area of real growth is pharmacy services for nursing homes. A big area of growth. They're called consulting pharmacy or lawn care pharmacy.
Oh, interesting. How about people who leave being a druggist and go into working for the drug companies themselves?
Yeah. People have successfully made that transition. We have some very successful alumni in the pharmaceutical industry. This is an industry that pharmacists can go into a variety of roles, especially the regulatory components of the pharmaceutical industry. You see a lot of pharmacists there.
I don't know what that means.
Well, understanding compliance with FDA regulations in terms of manufacturing, anything from the drug approval process to the manufacturing, to all the regulatory issues with labeling and advertising around drugs. So there is regulatory aspects of almost every step of the pharmaceutical industry, and pharmacists are actually well-trained to do that.
So just to put a cap on this, if they specialize in doing that and working for the drug companies, who do they go around to talk to? They go around to talk to the pharmacies and say, this is what your responsibility is, or the doctors, what do they do?
It depends on where in the drug development cycle they are. So they could predominantly report, ultimately it all goes back to the FDA.
Right.
So all the regulatory stuff. So getting a new drug approved is this complicated clinical trials process that ultimately has to get FDA approval. Pharmacists can be involved in that development process.
How so? I'm sorry for bothering
Okay, so a clinical trial has multiple stages. First, you're testing toxicity in animals.
Sure.
Then you have a test toxicity in humans, and then you scale up those things. So a pharmacist is the person who thinks about dosages. So I want to test toxicity. I want to figure out what dosage do I start with, and how do I monitor that? And a lot of toxicity of drugs is related to how quickly you clear them. If it's very slow to clear, my second dose bumps me up higher and higher, and each dose I get higher and higher. So pharmacists are trained to understand how drugs get cleared from the system and how to dose them. So that whole clinical trial process is a great area for pharmacists. A formal application has to go to the FDA after the clinical trials and all that. If it's approved, that's half the step. It has to become adopted. So the drug's approved by the FDA. It used to be, it's approved and we're on easy street. Now it's approved and we got to make sure it enters the practice of medicine. And so after it's approved, you have to manufacture
it. So do they become salespeople?
You see pharmacists in sales and marketing.
Well, when I go into my doctor's offices, I quite frequently see very well, very attractive, very well-dressed, neat people, young people sitting there with briefcases. That's who they are?
They could be pharmacists. They certainly could be.
Right.
But so there's a diversity.
Is that where the money is to be made?
So it's interesting. A pharmacist that goes into pharmacy, the practice of pharmacy, will start out at a very high salary, over 100. But over the course of their career, it may not progress. And someone that goes into the pharmaceutical industry will start significantly lower.
Interesting.
But it could progress quite rapidly.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a short-term versus a long-term. And it's also what people want out of their careers. So there's a whole range of careers for pharmacists.
Well, we're talking to Dr. Gregory Dewey, the 9th president of the Albany College of Pharmacy. Dr. Dewey, you just set everybody back on their heels and wrote a very interesting column for the Chronicle of Higher Education. What made you write it?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, I was reflecting back on my first year, and I thought, you know, it's been a good year. I've had some surprises, different things. And I thought, well, maybe others could learn of my experience. And so I just wrote something up as you know, recommendations from some people I should look at doing that.
In other
that.
Words, if you're going to become the president of a college of pharmacy, these are the things you probably ought to do.
Well, just any college. It wasn't just a college of pharmacy. Yeah. It was a very general statement. And, you know, there's been a huge literature on leadership and leadership in academia. I'm like, well, can I really make a dent in the leader in that literature? But I thought, you know, it's a dynamic world. Things change, pressures change. And so I thought I would write a little bit of article of sort of lessons learned from my first year. And it got picked up by the Chronicle of Higher Education and was published by them. And that was very gratifying.
Well, let's go over some of what you wrote.
Yeah.
One of the instructions you give to people, prospective college presidents or college president, is to know your institution. What right. do you mean by that?
So when you're in the interview process, I think you have a chance, you have an opportunity to really investigate the school, understand what it's about. But I think there's a natural tendency to pigeonhole it. So, oh, I'm going into a liberal arts college. I know what that's about. And in your mind, you pigeonhole. Or I'm going into a research university. I know what that's about. But in fact, until you're actually there, you don't really understand the institution. And the history of an institution is very important.
Absolutely.
You have to understand,
sure,
how did we get here? Because you'll come in and there will be certain illogical things. And you're like, why do they do it this way? Or why are these people over here and not over here? And then once you begin to understand the history, then it helps you realize how you got to the point you are.
But it also means that you may intuitively want to make some changes. And some institutions resist change.
They absolutely resist change. Change is the hardest thing to to do. And so you have to understand, if you go in and start to undo some things, then you have to understand how you got there to begin with. So you have to understand what you're undoing, because you may be thinking you're correcting a problem over here when you're actually creating another problem.
Mm-hmm. Unintended consequences.
Right.
Interesting. You know, you have a faculty, of course. You're a college president. You're a university president. As a lifelong academic, I can tell you that sometimes things don't go easily between presidents and faculties, only because faculties are very prickly about, you know, having their rights and things. My sentiments have almost inevitably been with the presidents of these colleges, because I think they have a better universal view than some of the faculties, but that's another whole story. So, you know, is the faculty at a college of pharmacy different, you think, psychologically different than in a liberal arts institution?
That's an interesting question. I would say yes and no on that one. I would say faculty, there are some pretty common faculty behaviors. You have to understand that most faculty spend their entire career at one institution. So you'll have faculty that are there for 10, 20 more years and don't really know anything outside of their institution. And that's pretty common, and especially among smaller colleges. Their perspective is only from the perspective of their institution.
That place.
Yeah, that place.
And history means a lot. When I got to New Paltz, they had a guy who was often thought of as a dictator for years, being the head of New Paltz. When they got rid of him, the next several people had to fight their way through the faculty, who believed that, you know, every college president was going to be like the first guy.
Yeah. Well, that's also what happens is you have swings, so that, you know, the perceived weaknesses of the first president, you kind of overcompensate.
Exactly.
And then it kind of swings back and forth. And it's sort of the devil you know also is part of that. But it's very important for a college president to be accessible and to be a good communicator and to really have a strong dialogue with the faculty. And
do they take advantage of that? Do they come in and talk to you?
They do, but I'm usually so busy that we have to structure it. But I do like to have settings, informal settings, to talk to faculty I like the settings of town hall meetings because it has an exchange of ideas and it has a different energy than some of the formal meetings. Not all presidents are comfortable with that format.
That leads us into the second thing you recommended, which is knowing your staff. Now, I take it that not only means how many assistant professors and things you have, but also who the opinion leaders among your faculty are.
Yes. So you have sort of the official leaders and then you have the real leaders,
right?
The behind the scene. You have to identify those. But with that article, I was really referring to your senior staff and your immediate reports. And you kind of go into an organization and you feel like you know strengths and weaknesses. But what you really have to assess early on is, do you have a team and who the team players are? You can have a very competent staff member, great expertise, who's off there doing his or her own thing and maybe has to be reined in at times because you want to really build as a team and not just expertise.
So let me go there for a minute. What do you mean reined in? Give us an example of something, without you naming names, of course, that you might have to rein somebody in on.
Okay, let me do a hypothetical case.
It's all hypothetical.
Title IX is a big issue on college campuses. And for a small college...
And what is it?
So Title IX, originally, back in the day, it was all about women's athletics and equality women's athletics. Now, it's about sexual violence on campus and how we handle sexual violence and
gotcha.
Our process and protocols.
Now, what percentage of your colleges are women?
60%.
Okay, so you got a lot of women.
Yeah. So Title IX is a very, has made a lot of national headlines, people mishandling things. And there's now this whole sort of sets of protocols and procedures we have to be very attentive about. And it's a challenge for a small campus to make sure you do a good job with that.
So
you're trying to build kind of a campus culture and how we deal with Title IX issues. And then...
have somebody who used to do it the old way.
And then the dean of students sends out a campus email about Title IX that the rest of your campus doesn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, okay, so what's going on here? Who are you communicating with? We're having this broader discussion, and you send out this email. That's what I mean about the kind of behavior. You have to make sure you're working as a team.
As a team. I even found that here in a public radio station.
The chances are it's well-intended.
Sure.
But it's not what you want because you have an important issue. You want everyone to wrestle with it, and you don't want a single player out there sort of doing their own things.
Right.
So I always thought the single player doing their own things was a result of a weak president. But in fact, often it's also a result of a strong president because staff members will hide things from the president because they want a level of autonomy. And if they're not getting it, the easiest way to get it is to kind of, you know, cover things up so you don't get the whole story.
So. Well, exactly. So I say to my staff here, and we have a pretty big staff, I say, don't protect me. I don't want to be protected. I want to know everything that's going on.
Yeah.
Well, that's a tough thing.
That is a tough thing.
To know.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have to decide on things like while we're on staff, who gets tenure and who doesn't.
That's right. And those can be very difficult decisions.
What are some of the things you look for in a tenurable candidate?
So I look for the utility player. I don't necessarily look for the home run hitter, the three pillars of a tenure decision are teaching, scholarship, and service. And by utility player is I want somebody that does all three of those well. And that's the sweet spot. Often you'll get someone with a big strength in one area and maybe a big weakness in a different area. And that's when you get difficulties. The academic bias is scholarship comes first, but at the end of the day, our mission is to educate students.
Uh-huh.
And so teaching has to be very important.
And how important is research? Do your people get a lot of grants? Do they commit themselves to finding things that nobody knew before, considering the fact that education of your students is number one?
Yeah, but you have to understand, too, with the progress of science and the impact of science on healthcare being so quick and immediate, we have to have a strong research component. We have to have people that know what the cutting edge is, because it doesn't take long for the cutting edge to be translated into a new therapy. So it's important that we have that vibrancy of our research.
Not to be crass, let me stop you, Dr. Dewey, and ask you, who owns the patent when they discover something?
If it comes out of our work, we own the patent. And when we talk about technology transfer, that is when we talk about putting the patent into, because we also cover the expense of prosecuting
sure.
the patent. But we create situations where the inventor will recover any royalties that come from the patent. So we divide those up.
Can
it's
you name,
to incentivize that.
Here's a question. I hope it's okay. Have you ever had one thing that has come out of that College of Pharmacy that really was a blockbuster?
As a blockbuster, well, we have right now something in the works.
Really?
So that we have something called the Pharmaceutical Research Institute, which is run by Shakir Musa. They're working on these nanomedicines, this technology where you create these little capsules that have medicinal value that you can use to target specific tissues. So you can actually have very low drug doses and get rid of a lot of toxicity. And have formed a company called Nanopharmaceuticals, and we have a good patent portfolio for those. And we are doing toxicity testing now in animals for some of those products. And we're very hopeful of the future of nanomedicine and Shakir Musa's work. But it's like, you know, drug discovery is a very tough business. It's, you know, the numbers of successes are very small.
They are.
And so it's like hitting a big home run. You don't hit singles and doubles. You either hit a home run or you don't.
Well, as long as you're on the baseball analogy, do you trade for great players? In other words, do you look for somebody who is somewhere else? Try to lure them over, because you know that if they continue the kind of work they've been doing, it might mean great returns for the Albany College of Pharmacy.
You know, I've only been here a year and a half, so we haven't recruited a lot of faculty under my tenure. Yeah, I'm probably more of the Moneyball philosophy about that.
In other words, sort of overall understanding of what it will take statistically in order to produce,
yeah,
as opposed to going for a Babe Ruth.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, interesting, exactly. Interesting. Okay, so then after Know Your Staff, we come to Know Your Trustees. Now, here, I suppose you'll have to be careful, as any of us who run a not-for-profit would have to be careful. But what do you mean by that?
So, you know, the relationship with the trustees is an interesting one. You know, ultimately, they're your boss. And,
indeed.
But you have to get to know them. But they're not your boss in the normal boss sense, in that often, you know, you may not see some trustees, but maybe two or three times a year.
If that.
Yeah, and so it's an interesting relationship.
What do you have to watch out for?
What you have to watch out for is divisions within the board. You want to make sure the board's cohesive and is everyone's rowing in the mind, so that you don't have political factions.
Right. I couldn't agree more. But what if you find a guy who is just out for blood? You know, my twin brother Lewis, who was a great not-for-profit leader, used to say that the worst reason to get on a board is for blood sport.
And, oh, that sounds like a nightmare.
Well, but it happens every once in a while.
Yeah.
What do you do?
I think you want board members that are committed to the institution. It's like, if you ask the question, why are you here? They have to believe in the institution. And it's not a vocation for them. It's not, you know, it's not a form of entertainment. And so I think you need to have a heart-to-heart with these folks about the behavior and their motivation.
Dangerous.
It is dangerous. But, you know, the angle is we're all in it to advance our individual agendas, but the institutional agenda.
But what is it that most board members are basically looking for? There's a certain amount of prestige that they get for serving on a board, right?
Right.
But when I find that the number one reason is always, are you on a sound fiscal basis?
Absolutely.
Because that's their ultimate responsibility.
That is their responsibility, and their, you know, it, it's important to engage the board at a very high visionary level. I think they want to be part of that vision moving forward. How do I advance this? I believe in this institution. I believe in what they do. I believe in what happens with our students. And I want to make a difference, so you have to open up an avenue. How do I advance it? You don't want them worrying about the grounds or, you know, this and that. You don't want them in the weeds. You want them up there in...
But what if they come to you and say, you know, and get involved in something they have no damn business in? You know, I don't like this professor. He spoke rudely to me. Or I don't like this program. You know, it involves my religious upbringing, and I don't think we ought to be messing around in it. How do you explain to them that ain't your job?
Delicately. That's where you have a tough job. That's where you have a tough
job. That's why they pay you the big bucks.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, you know, the board is, there are certain social aspects about your interactions with the board, expectation of certain social things. But at the end of the day, it's not a social club, and you can't,
Well, give me an example of a social aspect.
Well, so we have dinners before our board meetings,
sure.
And I try to go out to lunch or breakfast with each board member at least once or twice a year. And you know, you'll have, you know, the golf tournament. You'll have situations that
you have to do.
Relaxed social situations, but at the end of the day, you have to remember they're not there to be your friend, or you're not their friend. That they're your boss, and that's. That's the bottom line, right?
Right. Well, I think your number three issue may be one of the most hairy of all of the things that a college president or any other not-for-profit president, you know, has to worry about. The trustees, after all, as you say, are your boss, and, you know, they need to be educated, and they need to be talked to, and they need to respect you.
And I should say, I've had a great experience with our board. We've added seven new members since I've been here, and I'm very excited about.
Do you have to raise money?
I hope so.
And do you have to raise it from them?
We do. Well, there's an expectation of giving from the board.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Then finally, know thyself. Know yourself.
Yeah.
You have to know who you are. You have to know what your upsides are, your downsides are, right?
Yeah. I think you have to figure that out, because see, most presidents have been academics their whole life, and each job as they move up the ladder, each job is still an academic job. But when you become president, it's not necessarily an academic job anymore.
Which is why more and more lawyers are becoming the heads of universities.
Yeah, right. So you have to do fundraising. You have to do friendraising. You have to, talk to the radio host.
Like it or not.
Yeah, so you have a much broader portfolio, and you were never prepared for it coming up through the academic ladder.
Well, let's take you. Do you like it?
Absolutely, I like it. And I didn't, you know, I don't know what I would necessarily like it or not like it. So let me give you an example. Alumni relations. When I was provost, I thought, alumni relations, that's something the president has to do. And they meet with a bunch of alumni, and you check the box, and you move on to your
next.
For
the people who are listening, the provost is generally the chief academic officer, as opposed to doing all the things that the presidents have to do.
Good. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. So, I hadn't really thought too much about alumni relations. And, you know, I found that I love meeting with our alumni. I love hearing their stories. I love hearing their life stories and the things they wrestled with. And that was completely unanticipated that I would embrace that. But the other thing, know yourself, is I think a lot of it goes to communication styles, too, that different venues work better for different people, and you have to play into your strengths.
So, for example?
So I had, and Gil Trebajian can attest to this, I did a spot where I was being filmed, and I was reading a monitor, you know, with the script on a monitor.
Sure.
I had a terrible time doing it. I couldn't do that. I couldn't get the pace right. But I love town hall meetings. I love the informality of a town and the give and take But that scripting from a telemonitor...
It takes time.
Yeah,
I did it for 30 years on television. I know it takes time.
Well, you must have been good at it because I was struggling.
Got better at it.
I struggled.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is finding your style. See, you have to find your style of communication, what venues work best for you. The other example I gave was, you know, presidents write these newsletters like once a month, informational thing, and they tend to be kind of insipid. You know, they're sort of like a bunch of newsy little things.
Sure.
And I thought, you know, why do that? Why do that? And then so we started in that along that path doing newsletters. But then over time, we started morphing those into like little mini essays. So instead of being a newsletter, I write a little thought piece about something that happened recently.
Great idea.
Or in the and that ended up working well for me. It might not work for somebody else. A different form of communication, but so knowing yourself is sort of knowing what your strengths are, playing to your strengths, not necessarily ignoring weakness, but if you know you're weak in a certain area, don't keep pushing yourself in that area. And it's about also, you know, the other big thing is just the number of events that you're overwhelmed with. You have event after event after event.
Absolutely.
And if you don't like all those events, you need to pace yourself. You need to figure out intentionally, I'm not going to have, you know, five events in a row because I'm not going to do well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I need to spread those events out. So that's just about finding your comfort zone.
Yeah. I want to ask you very quickly, because we only have about 4 minutes left, about ethics. Not your ethics, not the college ethics, but it seems to be ethics are getting more and more important. We take, for example, oxycodone epidemic that is out there.
Yeah.
It's got to be tempting every once in a while for a pharmacist to get tempted.
I'm sure it is. And we had an alumni magazine where we talked. There was a testimonial from a pharmacist that had become addicted.
Happens with doctors, happens with pharmacists.
Yeah. No one's immune to that.
Do you teach ethics?
Yeah, we have ethical components to it, to the curriculum. You know, actually, you know, this is a good role, I think, for continuing education.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, it's not like you get all this stuff and it's done, it's over. I think people need to keep being reminded.
Well, do you have a request? Do pharmacists like doctors and lawyers have continuing ed requirements?
Yes, they do. And we have a pretty robust continuing ed component to the school that we offer to pharmacists.
Yeah, terribly important, because every day there's something new.
There is something new, and it could be a new temptation, but they're good. It's a good reminder. And it also brings people, your peer group, together. I think having that peer group helps.
We've been in conversation today, our second conversation, with Dr. Gregory Dewey, the 9th president of Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Dewey, I certainly thank you, and I hope that we will be doing more of these as time goes on, because I always learn from you. It's a great pleasure.
Yeah, let's make this an annual tradition. I enjoy our conversations as well.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.